I think I'll start with introductions. So hello, everyone, and welcome to the Cyber War and Geopoly Cyber Warfare Club. My name is Sam Stepanian. I'm a cybersecurity expert from London. And today we will be discussing the topic of Russian cyber war escalation linked to the announcements that Finland and Sweden will be applying to join NATO. So Cyber War and Geopoly Cyber Warfare Club features open discussions on geopolitics, plus political, ideological, terrorist, extremist, religious, and other geopolitically motivations behind cyber attacks, and how to better mitigate, defend, and protect national sovereignty and corporate entities in the light of cybersecurity failing daily and on unprecedented scales. So let me introduce the panelists we will have on stage today in this room. Today's discussion will be moderated by Gutta Hegarty, who is the founder of the World by Women Club, which is a space to give women voices, a place of their own on Clubhouse, showing their perspectives on subjects that are shaping our world and affecting our lives. Gutta has worked as a journalist for several Brazilian news agencies for over 12 years. Next, we have Abdul Hakim Ajijola, who is one of the top global cybersecurity professionals, influencers, and thought leaders. He is a commissioner for the Global Commission on the Stability of Cyberspace. He is also chair of the Working Group on Cyber Incident Management and Critical Information Protection of Global Forum on Cyber Expertise. He is listed on the United Nations Office for Disarmament Affairs, UNODA, roster of experts supporting the development of an online training course in cyber diplomacy. Abdul Hajjol is also a founding member of the Organizations of the Islamic Cooperation and a Computer Emergency Response Team, instigator of the Office of the National Security Advisor in Nigeria and the Computer Emergency Response Team there. He's also a member of Nigerian Cybercrime Working Group and a group of experts for the Nigerian Senate Committee on Cybersecurity and ICT. And he's also a former Senior Special Assistant on Innovation and Technology and advisor on national security to the President of Nigeria. Next, we have Khalid Fatal, who is the group chairman of the MLI group, also known as Multilingual Internet Group. Khalid Fatal is also the President Advisory Committee member on the Internationalized Domain Names and ICANN, which is the Internet Corporation for the Assigned Names and Numbers, which is the organization responsible for internet addressing. And Khalid has been a strong advocate of things like internet multilingualism. So if English is not your first language and you use internet in your native language, we have Khalid Fatal to thank for this, because he was one of the pioneers of multilingual internet many years ago. Khalid is also an active promoter of research, development, education, and deployment projects, which help to make the internet more usable and inclusive. And Khalid Fatal recently has been actively researching the topics of cyberterrorism from threat actors such as ISIS and the Rogue States. He is also a publisher of the news website called Survivability News, and also founder of Survivability Wealth Management. And Khalid Fatal was also one of the first people to introduce the term called geopolycyber warfare. So geopolycyber warfare refers to the warfare which leverages cyber attacks and the latest tools in technology, media, communication, purpose disinformation, for example, fake news, false narratives, etc., and also intelligence sabotage, to name a few, for the goal of coercing, altering, and damaging the political and economic prosperity, fate, and directions of nations and organizations. So welcome our panelists. So I would like to start today's discussion from a synopsis. So as what we will be discussing today is the following timeline of events. So as you know, Finland and Sweden officially applying to join NATO. After that, Russian government spokesperson said that Russia's response is currently in the hands of the Ministry of Defense. Also, in January 2022, Finnish diplomats and staff of the Foreign Ministry complained that their phones were hacked. And Times of Israel newspaper quoted that Pegasus malware, the infamous Pegasus malware used to hack journalists and politicians' smartphones, was actually quoted as being in play here. And Finnish Security and Intelligence Service later said that a state actor of some sort was likely behind this hack. Also in April, 2022, the websites of the government of Finland were hacked and forced offline during President Zelensky's speech to the Finnish parliament. And Sweden recently announced that they were hacked by Russian state-sponsored hackers. And there is also satellite-related events recently. As we know, Elon Musk is the founder of not only Tesla and SpaceX, but he also owns something called Starlink, which is a system of thousands of satellites orbiting the Earth, aimed to bring internet to the entire planet. However, as we know, Elon Musk has actually sent quite a lot of his satellite kits to Ukraine, which prompted a response from Russia's space agency, of course, didn't like this. And there was also a massive hack of Viasat satellite systems back at the beginning of the Russia-Ukrainian events. And just recently, we had officially days ago, U.S. government, Anthony Blinken, publicly attributed this satellite hack to Russia. And this was supported by the United Kingdom and European Union support of this U.S. claim, which was based on their own investigation. And the United States has actually started increasing security at many of the satellite ground stations due to the Russian cyber threat. So today, the first questions to debate, Khalid, I'm going to ask you, what do you think is going to be Russia's possible response? Khalid, you're on stage. I think you're muted. Can you please unmute yourself?
I was muted. You're absolutely right. And thank you for reminding me. Before I answer that question, Sam, I want to thank you for this detailed but very, very accurate sequence of events that put things into the correct perspective, because unless we really are dealing with facts, any conclusion we come out with will be nothing but fiction. And we're only interested here with dealing with facts, so at least we know what we're doing. So the question you're asking is so critical, because we don't need to be just students of history. In the last few months, when the Russian invasion of Ukraine kick-started, the fundamental reason behind Putin giving that order was his belief that Russia was under an existential threat by Ukraine joining NATO, and certain fundamental facts most people may not be aware of, but we need to put that into the correct perspective here is there has not been a single case of a NATO nation, an incoming NATO nation, that actually refused the deployment of arms within its territory by NATO. So the prospect of Ukraine joining NATO and vetoing NATO in deploying nuclear missiles on its territory aimed at Russia is highly unlikely. NATO and the US have always done what they wanted to do. So that in itself is part of the if you call it the awareness that led the Russia, and I'm giving you here my assessment. This is not fact that I have this directly from the office of Vladimir Putin, but the reality here is Russia is highly likely to have decided to invade Ukraine because President Putin determined that if he did not invade at that time, and Ukraine does apply to join NATO, NATO members do approve the application and it joins, at that particular moment, Ukraine becomes untouchable. And that was huge risk, and not to be put in a position where for the next 100 years, the West and NATO will be threatening it continuously. So therefore, I believe their decision, the decision was to invade, was because of that situation. Now, why this is irrelevant for us to put on the table and become aware of is because the war has been ongoing for now for many, many weeks, and it does not look like likely that it's going to be concluded in any peaceful resolution or militarily anytime soon. So now we have Finland and Sweden officially requesting to join NATO, and the prospect of two additional countries on the border with Russia becoming members adds to this existential threat perception of Russia and the Russian government and many of its people that now they are under further threat. So anybody who thinks there will not be some response is either smoking something or daydreaming. There will be a response. The question here is now, what is a likely response? So here now what I'm going to put out there is potential scenarios. Some of them are undesirable, unlikely, and I will conclude with what I believe is going to be the most likely scenario. Vladimir Putin and the Russian government have the option of doing an invasion of Finland and Sweden. Is that likely to happen? I believe not, because it cannot, for obvious reason, it cannot afford to be on three different fronts, and there are many other possible negative consequences that that could lead from this. So that a military action in the same form as what we have seen in the Ukraine, I believe, is unlikely, and Vladimir Putin will actually try to avoid this. But his reputation and his image as a strong man and capable of protecting his own nation is at stake, so he cannot appear that he's taken a token gesture. So it needs to be an action of certain size, certain weight, and certain complexity that people will say, ah, we didn't expect this, but at the same time, it cannot be token. So don't expect what we do in the West, a lot of you know, shouting and screaming like the U.S., talking about sanctions. Oh, sanctions, we're going to throw sanctions. It will be something of action. So that's one. So invasion, limited action invasion, I also think that is a slippery slope. An invasion itself is highly unlikely. I could be wrong on that one. Some economic activities, maybe the withholding of the delivery of gas and oil to certain Europeans, just to let them know, well, you know what, there's a price for everything. This is also possible. There are other scenarios, but I'm going to get into the most likely scenario and why. So the session today asks, to start with, it says, is Russian cyber warfare at Sweden and Finland about to escalate to unprecedented heights, including cyber attacks on their critical national infrastructures, now that both nations have officially applied for NATO? And I truly believe this is the most likely scenario. And when I talk about unprecedented heights, I'm talking about something that Russia can exercise, can act. We all know that cyber attacks are happening all over the place. Many may have believed that cyber attacks became a topic of conversation between Russia and Ukraine because an actual war erupted. But that cyber warfare or geopolis cyber warfare has been ongoing for years. And we have numerous examples to elaborate there. But just because people were not seeing bombs landing and innocent people dying, they didn't realize there was a war. But the truth of the matter here is this has been ongoing and escalating, but it's sort of like not in the public face. People don't see it on a daily basis because it's all in a virtual reality. So what is Vladimir Putin likely to do with this cyber warfare escalation? And why is it more likely than any other scenario? Going to a nuclear response is definitely the most that he would want to avoid, and the same thing by NATO countries. But the reality here is the cyber attacks and the cyber warfare is already happening. What Vladimir Putin and the Russian government will be able to do and can do is target critical national infrastructure. And if you can do enough of the certain enough attacks on critical national infrastructure in Finland, in Sweden, this has the capability of creating ripple effect of damage throughout society. Electricity to the general public, food supplies, transportation, you name it, literally attacks on critical national infrastructure will cause a debilitating impact on any nation state, let alone ones that that are believed to be causing an existential threat to your nation. And why this is more likely to happen is it does not make Russia look as if it's doing another traditional invasion. So it cannot say we're invading. Whether the attacks will be done on behalf of officials within the Russian, if you want to call it the sphere of influence or distant parties, that's just detail. National security agencies have always had third parties that work on their behalf that to give them the plausibility of deniability to say, well, it's nothing to do with us, this is not our official policy. More and more importantly, it takes away the perception or the appearance that Russia has taken an actual steps towards war. Because cyber warfare is ongoing, it does not require a declaration, and nor does it require any change in a political standing. Unless countries all of a sudden adopt laws to say, if you attack me, I will treat this as a declaration of war. And then you have to create attribution. You have to, and we all know that sometimes in this space, being certain about attribution is like being certain about things that are impossible. So this is where I truly believe the escalation is going to be, and the dire consequences on normal day-to-day life in Finland and Sweden would be put at huge risk. The damage is can be beyond comprehension. But it will give Russia the way out of saying, well, we did not launch a war and there's nothing that you can do that could trigger further escalation. Of course, we will expect many in the West and many governments of the West, UK, US, to start, you know, pointing fingers. But pointing fingers is not an escalation. I hope I am wrong. But I would suspect time will tell us whether this is as close to what will happen or not. And I'm also of the belief that there's the possibility of a surprise action, which is something that none of us considered. One other thing for us to consider here is superpowers have ways of dealing with each other in directly and indirectly. So one can expect that Russia could raise issues in other parts of the world where the US has interest, and I would also suspect there may be some kind of a collaboration or an agreement that Russia and China could sign and publicly announce that they are creating a pact between each other so that they are creating joint defenses. These are scary times. It's alienating countries and nations more than ever, and it's putting us closer than ever to a major disaster. I hate to say it, and I don't want to use the word with the letter N, but all it takes is just one miscalculation, and everybody feels as if they are justified in their action. And unfortunately, not everybody is justified in their action. So this is my two cents, and I'm happy to take questions and also debate and have other people's thoughts on this. And by the way, This is my opinion of this, based on extensive analysis, and feel free to disagree. There's no right or wrong here. And perhaps also feel free to shed more light that could validate or disinvalidate what I'm saying. So this is really meant to be a conversation, and it's open, and hopefully we will all conclude having learned something different and new from this engagement. Sam, the mic is back to you.
Thanks very much for this, Khalid. So the next question I have for you before Gota starts inviting other speakers on stage, please, it's about the satellite hack, because this flight itself was unprecedented, and apparently, right, this affected not just satellite communications, but also electricity as well, because, as you know, a lot of communication happens over the satellite networks. And
that's correct.
I'd like to hear your opinion on the possibility, because, of course, you mentioned critical national infrastructure, and, of course, previously we've seen things like Ukraine power grid being hacked. But satellites and Sweden and Finland, where can this escalation take us?
Well, that's an excellent point, and thank you for interjecting on this, because this actually is a critical new direction in the geopolitical warfare, because now we are invoking warfare through cyberspace. And for anybody who is aware of what Starlink is doing, what Elon Musk is doing, let me just give you some background. Elon Musk has launched close to about more than 2,000 satellites to offer broadband equivalent internet access from out of space. And by the way, we posted different stories and research on this on Survivality News, so feel free to go there and then do a search on Starlink or Elon Musk, and then you'll come up with these stories. But here's the thing. The only regulatory authority in the world that Elon Musk needed or asked for permission to be authorized to do this was the United States Communications Commission. That's basically it. So, in essence, by him being able to offer internet access to the world through satellites, he actually is bypassing local countries' authorities, governments, and regulators, and taking them totally out of the picture in the way they monitor and they actually regulate what is in the best interest of their citizens. What all of a sudden appeared to have become a serious gamesmanship in the chess game is the fact that Elon Musk's intervention to offer help to the Ukrainians after much of their communications and internet connectivity was curtailed through cyber attacks during the war recently, has actually been, you could say it was a success story for Ukraine and for the West, but it also shows you nobody is immune. Everybody is vulnerable. And all of a sudden now, this additional vector of internet from cyberspace that is totally, that's regulated or under the direction and supervision of the United States government, is becoming one of the chess, the activities of the chessboard within the gamesmanship of war games. It's no wonder that, if I recall in the briefing we just had, Dmitry Rogozin, the head of the Russian Space Agency, threatened Elon Musk that his head is going to roll for providing the Starlink satellite internet service to Ukraine. So these countries are actually calling out those who are supporting their enemies, and it's warfare. So I'm starting to see that there is definitely the risk of warfare in cyberspace, and some of these countries have the technologies to start attacking satellites. Because if you believe that a satellite operating in the ether above your head is a threat to your national security, you may go ahead and try to shoot it, melt it, do something to it. And now this is a totally new threat vector that we haven't considered, and it just opened up a Pandora's box. So I'm very alarmed at this, and but that's what happens when you're dealing with technology and you're not talking at resolving issues through political means. And in warfare, you know what they say, in love and war, all bets are off. And I'm suspecting that this is not going to end very nicely for many of the stakeholders involved. That's my two cents. If I miss on anything, Sam, please let me know.
No, that's absolutely fine. Thanks very much, Khalid. So, Gunter, can you please invite the
statements? Yeah, now, guys, this is the cyber war and jail cyber warfare club. Please follow our club, follow our moderators, our guest speaker, Abdul Hakim, and each other. Let's then pass the word for Abdul, who has just arrived joining us in this conversation, and after we will start with your questions and comments.
And before you start, Abdul Hakim, let me just take the microphone for 5 seconds, because Abdul Hakim, I think Sam gave the right tribute before he arrived about how credible this gentleman in the space of cybersecurity is, but he's also one of the most humblest you'll ever meet. So for all of the listeners, don't take his politeness anything other than he's one of the most courteous people. Abdul Hakim, the floor is yours, please. You may need to unmute yourself, I guess. Can you hear us, Abdul Hakim?
Yeah, we cannot hear you. I think there's an audio issue. So Guto probably invites Abdul Hakim a little bit later.
So Guto, please go ahead with the next potential speakers.
Okay, so we will start with Jawad. Jawad, please, the mic is yours. And after we have Tina, who is from Finland.
Thank you, Guto. This was very interesting to listen to. Welcome, Khalid and Sam, and hopefully, Abdul will join us shortly. Do you have any way of tracking actively the level of cyber attacks or cyber warfare in real time, Khalid? Thank you.
Let me put it this way. Sam, was that you who asked the question? I couldn't tell who was the speaker. I know it's not Sam. There's another person. If we could, I would not tell you that we could or we should. Nobody could track the abundance of cyber attacks in real time to any significant level. I can tell you that. And anybody who says they can, they are either delusional or they are trying to make you believe something that is not true. The more sophisticated you are in what you do, the better you are able to track. And a lot of the tracking is using technology, and technology has grave weaknesses that it misses, because technology is often designed by humans, and humans will only factor in into their design what they know, what they understand. So I'll give you a case in point. Part of what we do that's different from everybody else at the MLI group is, and why we created the term geopolycyber, is because cyber attacks traditionally, and they still are, treated as an activity that is a technical activity. Well, in actual fact, that is true, but it is not the entire picture. You could have a cyber attack by a thief who's trying to steal money, versus you can have a cyber attack by a terrorist or a nation state who is aiming to actually debilitate your nation. So the motivation is critical. And motivation is a human element. And you cannot mitigate that with just technology. So that's why a lot of the solutions that are utilized today, best of class, a lot of the strategies in cybersecurity and the solution cybersecurity, as critically needed as they are, alone, they are incapable to mitigate geopolycyber motivated attacks. Because they're only looking at defending, I guess, what has opportunity cost. And along the way, you still have weaknesses in the design because they don't factor motivation. I'm not going to go into more detail about this, but your question is very, very valid. We need to know more about what's out there and the frequency and the levels of cyber attacks, but to be able to track them all, it's impossible. One last case in point. Many of the cyber attacks that were, have been publicly disclosed, for example, Yahoo, what was it, Marriott, and many others, the hackers actually sat in the system for years and were looking and gathering intelligence from the flow of information, users' data for years, and nobody knew they were there. So how could that be assigned, assessed as a hack until it's disclosed or until it's found that it's a hack? So at least that gives you an idea how it's so difficult to say, well, we know there's 100,000. These are the 100,000 attacks that we know existed, but there are many that go undiscovered and the perpetrators are inside the system doing God knows what. So I hope that answers your question. I try to be brief, but I can't do it without just giving you the context. I hope that helps.
Yeah, so in essence, no, you don't have the ability to track them in real time. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. I'll pass it across to Tina and Patrick and then hopefully get a chance to ask some follow-up questions later.
Yeah, thank you, Shawad. And Tina is from Finland, and we also have Mitch from Sweden. And Tina speaks first and then Mitch, and then we again follow PTR.
Hello, Tina. Welcome back. I remember from the previous event.
Yes, good evening, Khaled, and good evening, Kuta, and everybody else. Good morning in America. I think we, Europe and Finland, we have 10:30 at the moment, 9:30 at the moment. Very interesting topic. I will try to point shortly what's going on in Finland at the moment. I've been following situation since Russian war started in Ukraine, and of course I'm a Finnish citizen, even I've been of course living in outside of Finland 10 of years, but now basically based on Finland, and I know very well also situation according the Russians influence so-called cyber attacks and info war. So first thing first, we have a discussion here in Finland for several weeks how to prevent possible cyber attacks from Russian sites in Finland. There are expected some possible attacks, but however, I have to say readiness, and I emphasize readiness in Finland, is very high. And this is not the first time we have cyber attacks. We have, of course, information war going on 80 years because we're living with Russian every day. And this is first time when the international news are very interesting about us. But thing is, in Finland, as gentleman mentioned here before, it's true, that there was massive attack, cyber attack, actually against the government's website. It lasted 8 hours when President Zelensky was giving his speech to Finnish government, and also some violations on the airspace. There are also some cyber attacks against our biggest banks. There were some attacks towards our biggest banks. However, we have to understand that Finnish society, as a Swedish society, we are very different from Ukraine. First of all, we have 5.5 million people in Finland, and in Sweden, approximately 10 million people. In Ukraine, approximately 45 million people before the war. So readiness and, of course, knowledge of cybersecurity is quite high in our societies because everything is digitalized. And of course, we were mentioned here, gentleman was mentioned here about cyber attacks against the infrastructure, water and electricity and mobile network. But I have to say here that Finland is prepared to run the country 3 hours with blackout. So there will be nothing we can see if there are attacks, because there is readiness to run the country. Even they will block our electricity and water and our mobile network. So this is the second thing. And the third, which is very important to understand, the program itself, what we have from 2017, and it's called Sleep Well, and it's comprehensive security program in Finland. And this is about understanding all kind of information attack. Hold on, can somebody have a mic here? Khaled? Okay, so it's about all the security defense, what we can have and what we can prevent regarding, for example, Russian influence at the moment. We didn't speak about here information war, and this is something we take very seriously. It's about advocates, it's about trolling in internet, it's about contacting diplomats, journalists or teachers or university leaders in campuses. This is something we have to be very aware of, because Russian has very good tactics, and we have 80,000 Russians speaking in Finland, and we feel very safe, and we don't discriminate anybody, but we have to be aware that time is changed at the moment. So I just wanted to give you these examples, and there's actually government's website. It's called Sleep Easy, and it's about our comprehensive security in Finland. And you can read here that this program has been going on from 2017. So it's a full program where it's in the field of security in with authorities, non-government organizations, companies and citizens for the first time. So actually Finnish government and Finland work together with all the principal actors in the field of security in order to prevent in future crisis, as we call cyber attacks or information, a hybrid information war, we can call it in those words. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Tina.
Let me just interject, Tina. Thank you very much for taking the time to elaborate on your intervention, because I. First of all, I know firsthand at some of the. Let me put it this way: I'm very familiar with some of the preparedness and the schemes that have been implemented not only in Finland but also in Sweden. I have some really very good colleagues who operate in those fields in both countries. And if we were to rank nation states in terms of preparedness level, both countries would score high against would score higher than most other countries. The purpose why we are so that's a valid point what you raised. The purpose why we are creating this session today and why we're creating this awareness here is because the key word in the title and the subject matter here is unprecedented levels. And this will test us all. This will test the best who are the best of those who are well prepared. And I'm hoping what we are doing and where the awareness we're creating to shed light of what's likely to happen is the scale of the attacks and the possible ruthlessness because it is perceived to be warfare. It's war. It's existence. It's war for existence. This is how it's perceived by both parties. Then guess what? All of a sudden now, all bets are off. Governments stop thinking that what they are doing is going to be hurting ordinary people's lives or damaging them or even destroying them. That's why we are doing this. So this is really more an awareness creation to decision makers to become aware. I'm talking about government decision makers, is that if you think you can play that game, guess what? No government, no country is immune. And the more you have to protect in your country, the greater the risk of you being compromised because it's all about identifying vulnerabilities. That's how cyber attacks become successful. And because systems are designed by humans, guess what? Vulnerability will always exist. And the more sinister the motivation is, the more devastating the consequence. So I hope that's really, you know, I'm hoping that those who are listening take into consideration this session today is to create awareness that we need to stop this nonsense. We need to stop the escalation of fear. We need to go back to the negotiating table, to using discussions to try and resolve issues. That's basically what we're doing. So thank you very much, Tina, for your intervention, and I hope what we are doing is will help in that aspect as well. Guta, who's next? Thank you, Tina.
Yes, we have now Abdul Hakim. Finally, I hope he can join us.
I hope you can hear me.
Yes, we can hear you. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
I was singing your praises of, you know, don't confuse his modesty with his effectiveness. I was hoping your mic was working. Abdul Hakim, the floor is yours, my friend.
Thank you, sir. First of all, it was lovely hearing from Tina. Let me just say kitos. I was actually in Helsinki last week. Having said that, I'm going to be a bit biased and maybe speak a little more from the Africa perspective because that's what I know a little more about. Now, in the context of Russia or cyber malfeasance, in South Africa, sometime last year, we saw the Transnetport ransomware attack, allegedly by Rival Group. But again, coming back to some of the things that and some of the high degree of confidence of Tina, you know, I would like to remind all of us that a few years ago we experienced the Arab Spring in North Africa. And during that those incidents, the political hacktivists self-infected themselves with botnet malware. And they went after two things. They went after the central bank clearinghouse. And they also went after the top-level domains of each of those countries. And so the playbook I'm just putting forward is that it's not simply about taking electricity during the summer or causing, you know, blips in water, but it's actually, if you're able to take down the central bank clearinghouse, You cannot deposit money, you cannot withdraw money, you cannot transfer money. And I would argue that, you know, regardless of the country, when citizens can't access their own funds, there's bound to be some level of trouble. In addition to that, these hacktivists went after the the top level domains, which means you couldn't actually access any, for example, .fi in the case of Finland, any Finnish website, or send or receive any email from a Finnish domain. And this, I think, has echoes of Estonia in 2007, which, you know, it's believed the Russians were behind. We've also seen in the past, and again, we're going back to antecedents here, Russian cyber attacks towards Georgia in 2008, and also actually Ukraine itself in 2014. And all of these attacks preceded kinetic incursions. And so though I've heard a high degree of confidence that there is unlikely to be a kinetic or kinetic incursion into some of the Baltic states, you never know how desperate people can become or leaders can become. Again, it's not exclusive to Russia. We've seen the Pentagon, commence some kind of cyber war on ISIS by attacking their communication command and control infrastructure. We've also seen, you know, again, the U.S. attack Iranian weapon systems, in partnership with Israel. And on the 6th of May 2019, I think the world actually saw the first case of a physical response to a cyber attack, which was by Israel. And just to touch on the issues of attribution, Khaled had spoken about, while technical attribution is relatively easy, not necessarily always accurate, the legal attribution, is it something that can actually hold up in court, is much more difficult. And certainly the political attribution is extremely difficult. Having said that, given the current political atmosphere in the West, there's probably a default to attribute almost anything to Russia at this point in time. Now, coming back to Africa, we've seen reports where the Russian Internet Research Agency, they were the ones who allegedly interfered in the U.S. elections, but they seem, if the reports are to be believed, to have outsourced their disinformation campaigns to certain parts of Africa. Ghana is one of the places that has been named. Now, that said, Russia also has suffered its own set of cyber attacks. There was the case of the Russian Aviation Regulatory Agency, which lost, I think, 65 terabytes of data was exfiltrated. And basically, the agency had to start using biro and paper. So it is, to some extent, or to a large extent, a two-way street. And I think where the surprise has been is that the Russian cyber capacity so far has not come across to be as sophisticated as we thought. But sometimes that's the illusion of secrecy. Now, having said that, also in Africa, we are very concerned about issues relating to digital espionage. And unfortunately, many of the tools used are often developed in the West. We've seen, the Italian hacking team, RCS, the response control system, allegedly used by Egypt, Ethiopia, and even my country, Nigeria, Morocco, and so on and so forth. And even the Israeli Pegasus software, as far as we understand, is alleged to be used by, again, Morocco, Algeria, Libya, Egypt, I think Ivory Coast, a surprising one, Togo for its small size, Uganda, Kenya, Zambia, Mozambique, and South Africa. Now, what adds complexity to our challenge in Africa with these international goings-on is that some of these things lend themselves, unfortunately, to digital authoritarianism. Many talk about it in the context of China, But I'll just note in closing that there are some African nations with advanced digital surveillance capacities: Algeria, Botswana, Ivory Coast, Mauritius, Morocco, Uganda, and Zambia. But there are also several African nations with organized disinformation capabilities, such as Angola, Eritrea, Ethiopia, Sudan, and Tunisia. And of course, sadly, there are quite a few African countries that seem to have both the advanced surveillance and the organized disinformation capabilities, such as Egypt, Ethiopia, Ghana, Kenya, Nigeria, Rwanda, and South Africa. So in just closing on this, unfortunately, we are learning some of your bad habits, and we are struggling because we have not yet, as nations in the continent of Africa, really defined what our ethical and moral values. And in some countries, those ethical and moral values actually do impose certain self-limitations. And so I'm worried about the genie that is being hatched out of the bottle. Thank you very much.
Let me take this. Abdul Hakim, thank you very much for your intervention. I mean, it's so important to take note of how ill-prepared so many countries around the world for normal cyber attacks, let alone destruction-motivated ones, or ones that are aiming to change the political direction and the economic fate of their nation states, let alone their businesses or their stakeholders. For those who don't know, Abdul Hakim has served as the chairman, and I'm labeling it in my own way so that people can relate to it. He was the chairman of the committee that was tasked with reviewing the cyber security strategy to advise the president of Nigeria. And I'm not going to put you on the spot, Abdul Hakim. Are you aware of any national cybersecurity strategy that is currently either being implemented or considered that can mitigate the level of attacks that could come from geopoly cyber warfare? Are you aware of any?
Let me just predicate my answer that there's a quote by Idi Amin that you have the freedom of speech, but he can't guarantee the freedom after speech. So I hope, Hadid, you guarantee my freedom after speech. Quick answer is no.
That is the most beautiful. I told you, ladies and gentlemen, I told you, don't confuse his politeness. I'm sorry if I was not trying to put you on the spot, because there's a...
I would like to talk.
There's something I want to share with all of you. Many of you may recall, and this pertains... something that happened, that to the greatest and the richest and the most powerful empire on the planet, the United States. Many of you may recall that 2-3 months prior to President Trump leaving office, the communications of the Department of the White House was hacked. More than 150 members of staff, their mobile phones, their computers were hacked. Ladies and gentlemen, the data was never found, sold on the dark web. Whoever intended to hack the White House communication department and its members got access to the strategic plans and the brain of the empire. If the richest nation on the planet with more money and brains than God can be so blatantly breached and be exposed, with the richest country on the planet having many of its infrastructure operations, telecom, transport, banking, compromised on daily basis, with the most advanced and up-to-date regulatory framework. What are your chances if you are in another country? I'm not belittling anybody. It's a reality check that to stay with cybersecurity strategies and cybersecurity mandates on to defend the nation state is lunacy to think that this will help mitigate the threat to nation states. And most decision makers are fearing to ask the question, what else we're not considering? What else we need to do differently to be able to mitigate and defend the nation state and our stakeholders? So I put that in perspective because at the end of the day, it's wonderful to feel confident that one's nation is prepared. And I would love to see many nations being prepared, but your mettle will only be tested during adversity. And I hope we never get to that. That's why we're doing the session as well. So it's time to really look in the mirror and ask ourselves, and for those who are decision makers in their governments or in their businesses, to say, are we doing enough? Have we covered all bases? What else can we not consider? And this is not a pitch for our service, by the way. I don't need the money. I'm not doing it for money. So just at least, if you need to know more, come to us and ask us. Show us some respect. We'd be more than happy to help you. Guta, who do Abdelhamid, do you have anything else to add to what I just said, or you want to remain polite?
I will remain polite.
Okay, so we are going to go to Mitch because he's representing Sweden, and then we can go to Patrick and Livia and Greco and Piotr, who is our friend arriving here to always bring his knowledge to our stages in Clubhouse.
Thank you. Mitch, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Khalid and Abdul. I'm Mitch. I'm based in Sweden. I just wanted to ask more about putting on your ethical hacker hats, right? So Sweden, of course, has made a new investment in putting the Sweden National Cybersecurity Center, like centralizing all things cybersecurity. That's an agency that has the Sweden Armed Forces, the National Defense Radio, and SAPO, which is our national NSA, under one roof. It's like cat and mouse. But lately, and for a number of years, Sweden has been fallen to cyber attacks. As early as 2015, the air traffic control was taken over a couple of days. And so we have been hacked. And lately, the bank, Swedbank and Avanza, was hacked. One of the large grocery chains, Coop, 800 stores were hacked. Axis were hacked. If you were to put on, and this is probably, you know, a question for Abdul and Khalid, what other areas do you think will they try to attack, areas that they attacked before, or they would attack something new like our bank ID system that controls everything? If you hack our bank ID, we won't be able to do almost anything, or attack a company like Visma, which is probably a similar situation to SolarWinds, or possibly Vattenfall, which is an electrical utility that controls the 3 nuclear power plants with 6 reactors. Where, if you were, you know, the bad actors or the hacking collectives in Russia, what will you target?
Abdul Hakim, I'll let you answer first, and I'll.
Okay. I would just like to respond with a couple of general observations, because I don't know enough to make too detailed. But first and foremost, while having this central authority sounds like a good idea, and it does have its uses and purposes, please also remember that it could potentially be a single point of institutional failure. And so you do need to have some level of more of a collaborative group rather than, you know, too stiff a structure. The other challenge I have, and this is just based on general experience, is that sometimes national security operatives are not well aligned to the requirements of, you know, cybersecurity issues. And what I'm getting at very specifically is that I'm sure in York and in Sweden, like in Nigeria and any other country, people who work for the security establishment are trained and paid to be black holes, that is, to take information, not necessarily to share information. And cybersecurity at a very, very fundamental level needs a mutual sharing approach. Of course, it has to be anonymized sharing. But like I said, national security operatives are not always very good at doing that. And so sometimes it's not always the best to have these kind of, as important as they are, directly under the purview of the national security establishment, but they can, must, and should be a component. But your other components have to be, you know, your government, generally the civilian government, even your operators, because they own most of the infrastructure, your civil society, because they are very good at getting the public and private sector to adhere to good governance. And even your media, because you do need to create enlightenment and awareness. And one last challenge that, and again, I don't know if you've observed this in Sweden, but in my part of the world, sometimes regulators of sectors are not very good at creating safe spaces for reporting. So sometimes if you get hit or you get hacked, because the regulator might penalize you or impose some kind of penalty on you, you're a bit hesitant to respond. And I mean, this is the same thing when, you know, like people won't report their HIV status if they think they're going to be, discriminated against. So I would encourage, you know, Sweden or any other country to ensure that they create safe spaces for the reporting of these incidents, because it's about the dependencies. You may think that you've got your supermarkets covered, all well and good, but if I'm able to hack the system like what happened in South Africa with Transnet, Transnet was the port, and Transnet also managed the pipelines that went inland. So if I cannot get the stuff off the ships, it doesn't matter how good your supermarkets are, the store, you know, the shelves are not going to be filled. Thank you.
Abdul Hakim, I'm really, thank you for an excellent answer. And basically, in summary, what you've done is you've established the importance of comprehensiveness. So, yes, the question was about the role of ethical hackers, understood. But ethical hackers are, the concept of ethical hacking is treated as if it's the greatest thing since sliced bread. And that's because we're used to sinister hackers or criminal hackers. But when you consider the number of ethical hackers versus the criminal or the sinister or destructive hackers, I mean, it's a losing battle. I'm not going to give away the secret sauce, but FYI, part of the cyber survivability strategies that we help governments and organizations implement is that you need to have an in-house operational team of you can call them ethical hackers, but their job is to identify vulnerabilities on ongoing basis, 24/7. My dear friends, the state that we are in is a race, and what may appear to be a no vulnerability today might become a vulnerability next week, which means you must tell yourself as a decision maker, whether it's government or corporate, that my task is, my strategic goal here is to make sure my ethical hacking team inside, in-house, are able to identify those vulnerabilities before the external threat actors are. And if I can do majority of those before they're exposed to the outside, I've actually shut down a lot of the doors that allows that. This is part, it's a component, exactly what Abdul Hakim was saying. It's a component of the strategy to be followed in securing the effective national survivability of a nation state. So this is very, very important. So yes, people are always amazed at, oh, ethical hackers are doing this. But this needs to be a formatted operation at corporate and at government level that is doing this 24/7. If you're not doing this guess what? You are exceptionally vulnerable. You're exceptionally at risk. And all of the bling bling and this and the gadgets you buy in cybersecurity cannot plug the possible holes of vulnerabilities you are exposed to that can actually not just shut you down, but bring you down to your knees. I hope that answers it in a diplomatic way. And it's really, it's about the change of mindset. And I'm hoping that that answered your question, Mitch.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Gutta, who's next?
We have now, it's Patrick, please. The mic is yours after we go to Livia.
Excellent. Thank you. Hakeem and Khalid, your insights are, excuse me, they track mine very well. I have 3 points I'd like to, excuse me, 1 second. Sorry, I have 3 points I'd like to add as well. For the Fortune 100's CIOs, it takes them about 2 years to realize that their hardware has even been compromised, and that's on average. So a hacking outfit can quite literally set up a secondary internet in a corporate network, and for 2 years, no one's going to see it, mostly because the corporate network is thrown across all these data centers and hardware regimes and all over the place, and it's very difficult to spot and modify, and you're going to have different vendor relationships and different in-house knowledge of it all. It's very difficult to even detect inbound what's actually been taken from you. The next point is cyber insurance, which is mostly a scam. It's almost impossible to price the risk of it. We all know that the risk is there. It's real and it's very tangible, but it's very difficult to quantify. And it shows up in cyber insurance products where you can't make a claim because there's nothing to actually measure. So the market price for all these premiums are really volatile and all over the place because of this lack of quantification. And the third point is, excuse me, the third point is that like 60% of cyber attacks start with phishing. People tend to think it's you fire up Kali, you get the pen tester going, and you just slam a couple IPs until something, you know, trips and screws up. But it's actually the psychological vulnerabilities of people where you actually start these sophisticated attack vectors. So cybersecurity needs to get out of the bits and bytes and boops and bling, and it needs to understand that there's also a psychosecurity component as well. Because if I'm an adversary, if I'm red teaming you, I'm going to identify the psychological predilections of your entire organization. I'm going to go to their social medias. I'm going to see how they post. I'm going to interact with them. I'm going to talk to them. I'm going to send them messages. I'm going to try and get them on dates. I'm going to understand what mental illnesses they have. Then I'm going to cluster them. And I'm going to find out, okay, well, these people have ADHD. So I know that my phishing attempt has a higher chance of registering with them because they're just going to click and move on and forget all about it. So the psychosecurity component is a huge part of cybersecurity, and it's just never really discussed. So anyway, that's all. Thanks for the floor.
Patrick, thank you for your intervention. I excellent points, and I'm pleased you brought this in. You call it psychosecurity. The motivation is at the heart of the geopoly cyber. I think the psycho element is wonderful. I like that, by the way, so I might, with your permission, use it at times. Let me just put what you just said in a perspective for those who think that this is just like a general topic. The phishing that you talked about, which is what a lot of the cyber attacks, 60% you quoted, start with, they are identifying information that can allow the hacker to find a way of getting in. Well, let me just give you this scenario. Most of you may have heard of the Marriott breach, 500 million records of Marriott's customers and users and their travel behavior, et cetera, et cetera. That information was never sold on the dark web, by the way. So somebody's spent some time and economic value to get that information, and they never sold it, so they never really got a payday. So what the hell are they using it for? Secondly, many of you may have heard of the Equifax cyber attack. Again, but this Equifax cyber attack is not just your Facebook login. This is your social security number, your mortgages, your marriages, your everything about your passport number. Ladies and gentlemen, imagine hypothetically, it's the same hackers or the same nation state, whoever. Imagine now they are reverse engineering and cross-referencing the data from both these hacks. They probably don't need to phish anybody. They have enough to go and target. And if they are motivated for geopolycyber goals, guess what? They will stick on it until they breach it. So we are really at a very, very critical point that recognize, and we need to recognize that it's no longer about the bling bling, exactly what Patrick said. It's about the motivation and how we update and upgrade our strategies in defending nation states and defending and protecting corporate security. Because the current system, I hope I don't offend anybody, I would suggest people take it to the nearest toilet and flush twice. It ain't working. If the greatest empire on the planet can be breached at such unprecedented scale, at such high levels, it should be a warning signal that something is not right and something different needs to happen. Patrick, thank you very much, and I hope I did your comment justice in my reply.
Okay, so we have now following up Livia, and David is back. So after Livia, we have David.
Hi, hello. First of all, thank you for this much needed, extremely needed, because a little background, I'm working with disinformation and misinformation, especially talking to an Italian audience. In fact, I have a live in about 3 minutes, so I need to be fast. I make my question, and then I will listen to it in a replay. So sorry to have to jump off, do the hard exit right after I ask the questions. So, as I said, I talk to Italian audiences about disinfo and misinfo, which is my area of expertise. But very, very often, of course, disinfo and misinfo goes hand in hand also with cyber war. And it's quite worrying from my point of view that all the lay audiences, they worry so much about, for instance, nuclear threat, but they don't realize that, as you said, as Khaled said at the very beginning, with cyber attacks, cyber war, you can actually pretty much cripple, blow up to smithereens a country without even having to use nukes. So I do believe that cyber war is the thing to worry about right now. So I go to my questions. I have two questions. My first question is to Khaled, if he can elaborate more on the Sino-Russian alliance. So the Sino-Russian alliance in cyber war has been going on for quite a while, has been going on since 2014, even regardless the bans and you know the sanctions that Russia has suffered after annexing Crimea and entering Donbass. And around last March, beginning of March, I believe March 3rd, a Chinese government official declared publicly that they intended to continue with their agreements in the field of information technology with their collaborations with Russia, and especially specified that they would continue especially focusing on big data sharing, ghost protocol aligning, and artificial intelligence. Now, this is extremely worrying. So I would like you to enlighten us on this subject. Also, because also in the information space, the alliance between China and Russia and along the BRIC countries, so therefore also Africa, I'm glad that Sam talked about Africa, it's pretty clear. And I wonder how it translates and how much we have to worry in cyberspace of these alliances? That's my first question. My second question is about food security. So, as we know, and I think just yesterday, we have proved that Russians are actually stealing grains, seeds, and maize from the big ships in the Black Sea. They are blocking the food chain by blocking the ships carrying seeds, maize, and grains in the Black Sea. They stole seeds, grains, and maize from Ukrainian farmers. But parallelly, what is happening in cyber domain, there have been an increase of attacks during harvest and during planting, and now there will be during harvest season. There were attackers to producers, to food producers, farmers, and supply chain. So which are the relationships and how this plot of creating a global food crisis, it's supported by those kind of cyber attacks to the food chain and to the food producers. Thank you, and sorry, but I will have to leave. I listen in until I can, and then I will have to leave. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Livia. I'll try to be brief. On your second question about food shortages, and I might need you to remind me about the first question because I forgot it, to be honest with you. I have a book titled Survivability coming out about 6 to 8 weeks. I think we'll post you the link so you can see what it's all about. In one of the chapters, I talk about something a journalist talked about at the turn of the 20th century, where he referenced 9 meals from disaster. In my book, I talk about we are now 3 meals from that disaster. The food shortages are, I hate to say it, but so easily created. And we've seen it in so many different parts of where there are even wars or conflicts, and they cause to force the position of governments to do certain different things. So that's one. So this cannot be mitigated by just simply a strategy on cyber or whatever, but this is really a serious, serious problem. Get the people hungry and you can see how they will run to try and change governments. We've seen it in Venezuela. A country that is as rich as you can imagine, that the blockade of it economically and food and all that stuff was causing people hunger. And that's a country that has, I think it has the third largest oil reserve in the world. The first question, Livia, you asked about the relationship and the prospect of the China-Russia alliances. Historically, it's no secret that the Russians and the Chinese, although they're supposedly communists, have had issues with each other. But what has united them is foreign policy by the United States and, to a large extent, position of the West. And everybody's looking after their interest. So there are a lot of alignments between both these countries and cooperation. But what we should really be concerned with is there's a lot of alignment that is not publicly discussed.
Khaled, your mic is gone.
Okay. I thought it was just me. Can I just quickly interject while we wait for him to come back?
Yes, of course, please.
Okay. To Livia's two questions. With your permission, I would like to quote a gentleman from Finland. He's a Finnish hacker whom I hold in a very high esteem. His name is Mikko Häyppänen. And he famously said, "We are no longer securing computers. We are securing society." And I think this is very critical. If Livia can put that across to her audience in Italy. In addition to that, again bringing our African perspective, the issues of elections interference. We've seen them in Kenya and Nigeria. And the point I'm trying to get at here is that it's far cheaper and easier to hack the mind of the electorate than to actually launch a single cruise missile at, you know, $1.6 million a pop. And the point I'm trying to put across here is that if you are able to convince a society to elect the wrong commander-in-chief, basically your society is in trouble. Your economy, whether it's your value chains like food security, whether it's your alliances, whether it's your national security establishment, and indeed your military, once you have the wrong leader or leaders, I think you can do far, far more damage than the threat of, you know, kinetic. And again, you know, a lot of modern weapons are very damaging, as unfortunately we've seen in many parts of the world. But I think that we are in an era where, you know, cyber can do a lot more damage to human psyche, human society, and human well-being. Thank you.
Abdul Hakim, your point was so valid. I hope my mic is working now. Can everybody hear me?
It's a bit low.
It's very low, hardly to understand at all.
Can everybody hear me, the president?
Nope.
Still very low.
Maybe you're covering your mic with your hands if you have an iPad.
Someone hack your mic.
I must have been hacked. Okay, but I was going to say something. I think Abdul Hakim raised a very, very important point. Disinformation, which is we call purposed disinformation, that's where false narratives, fake news, all of that falls under. This is a critical play today that many nations are engaging against other nations to try and curtail democratic processes. And you don't have to fire a single missile. And Abdul Hakim is absolutely right. I will leave it at that, and I will try to see what I can do with my mic. And Gutta, please continue giving the floor to the other speakers, please.
Hey, can I add something, Khalid?
Please.
Yes, go ahead.
Please do.
I just wanted to say it's very interesting, and I appreciate all your opinions, but I need to emphasize that we Finns, and I'm talking about a Finnish society and mentality, how we operate, we seems to be quite immune to the information warfare at the moment, because we do not engage in any conspiracy theories or manipulate popular movements. So it's very important to keep on track on facts, and I appreciated you all that we do so, because at the moment there's no any emergency threat from Russian side that we should be worry about not running our society as we do at the moment. That's what I wanted to add.
And you are here, another voice from Finland, if I may. You had an order.
Juha was talking as a Finnish. Yes, compliment what Tina was saying then, Juha. And then we'll pass to, if the speakers are finished, then we go to David, and then we continue the PTR.
Okay, if I may, sorry. I think Tina made the excellent point that I think the Finnish society is quite resistant and resilient regarding this.
Your mic is also very low.
Okay, now better, yeah. I hope. Okay, before Finland handed in the application for NATO membership, I thought that Russia woke up too late in order to try to influence Finland directly, and my suspicion was right. I said that they will try to address either Hungary or Turkey in order to bring them to a situation where they would prevent Finland from joining, because the decision must be unanimous within NATO. And I can't prove that Russia would have their fingers in this game, but if Russia would have exercised some kind of influence towards Turkey and encourage them to block Finnish membership, then the situation would not seem any different, to put it diplomatically. And I think that that's at the moment the biggest risk, actually, what we have, that the public opinion in Turkey will be influenced by some kind of information warfare things. It doesn't necessarily mean that the Turkish people or the Turkish media would be directly bribed or anything, but it's enough if they manage to get some insecurity and some strange rumors and these kind of things in the Turkish population, because that will in turn influence the parliamentarians, because they have to should fulfill the or execute their decision according to the opinion of the people. And if they manage to bring some kind of insecurity and doubts and claims into the Turkish population with this kind of information warfare, then I think that would be the risk, rather than any direct hostilities in cyber space or anywhere directly targeted towards Finland. Thank you. I'm done.
If I may add to that, going back to the cybersecurity point, I'm personally involved in the technique called blackmail.
Let's see if Khaled or Abdul would like to say something.
Thank you, Guta. Patrick, I'll give you the floor in a moment.
No, I'm enjoying this.
I hope you guys can hear me okay.
No, it's still very low. A little better, but very, very low.
Yeah. Here's the Turkey's position in regarding to showing concern about the applications to join NATO. Is really President Erdogan's gamesmanship to try to get some concessions from the Americans. He may get that concession. He may get a bigger concession from Russia. Now he has a bargaining chip that is worth its weight in gold. This is what President Erdogan is doing. I do not believe he has a particular position one way or the other, but it becomes a bargaining chip, and that can determine whether NATO will have new members or not. So that's what I wanted to add. Patrick, you want to add something else?
Sure. Thank you for that ad. That's a very good point. The project I'm a part of is called Blackmail Inflation, and this has direct implications on all democracies around the world, because when you have GPT-3 and DALL-E 2 coming out, these devices, these AIs, are able to generate content as quickly as you can think about it. So in the case of DALL-E 2, you type in any combination of words, and DALL-E will quite literally draw it to the point where you can type absurd things like a golden duck talking to a smiling bull, and it will quite literally make that image. So when you have this mass production of content, you are able to put all of the authorities in your society in these positions, and it looks real. It looks accurate. You cannot tell the difference. It's not even disinformation at that point. It is just an abundance of context that nobody can make sense of. You can't even see what's true or what's false anymore. So how democracy survives that without taking a serious understanding of its own psychosecurity situation while also trying to protect the mentally ill, it might be reaching for too much.
Good point. Thank you very much, Patrick. Guta?
Thank you, Patrick. And we have now Greco. Juha wants to intervene. Then we go to Greco and Chris. They've been waiting.
Yes, I just want to talk a very few things, because I like to more to hear than talk. But you can talk first.
Okay, thank you. I have just a few things. What Khaled just said. Just two observations, that before Finland handed in the application to join NATO, Finland obviously and of course had discussions with the different countries, and they every single NATO country gave a positive signal so far. So it came as quite a surprise that Erdogan then threw this bomb. And that's one observation, that something had changed during that time. And the second observation is that actually Erdogan is the only or this the absolutely strongest, strictest person defending this kind of situation, that all others, the foreign minister and everyone, they are willing to negotiate and so on. But Erdogan, one person, is very, very strict about this. And I just leave this in the room, that something or someone has changed something in Erdogan's mind during the, well, let's say 2 weeks after the initial discussions with Turkey and before Finland handed in the application. And these are just observations, and everyone could do the math according to the personal preference of arithmetics there. Thank you.
That's a fair point, Juha, I think, but I personally do not think that something changed. Turkey has had significant issue with the United States in recent years. This is not new. Turkey accused the United States during the Trump administration of plotting to overthrow the government, and many of you may have seen the tanks and the fighter jets trying to overthrow the Erdogan government. And Turkey accused a Turkish dissident who lived in the U.S. of plotting it with the help of the United States government. So this is an ongoing feud. Now, both Turkey and the U.S. are co-founders of NATO. So Turkey is not like an insignificant player. It's a founder of NATO. So all of a sudden now, this is – and also, if you recall, Turkey does not like some of the position of the United States regarding the Kurds and the establishment of a Kurdish independent state on its border with Iraq. So when you consider all this, the membership application to join NATO, which requires all NATO members to approve it unanimously, gave Erdogan the opportunity to say it's payback, USA. And now he is playing the hardball with the U.S., and he's going to see what compromises he can get out of them. And I would venture a bet that the compromise will be along the lines of the Kurds and perhaps the handing off, and I can't remember his name, the dissident who lives in, I think, in Colorado, who was accused of being the plotter of the coup against Erdogan, to hand him over to the Turkish authorities for trial in Turkey. So there's some symbolic gesture here for Turkey to say, well, you know, we stood up. Turkey may also choose to actually play ball and align with Russia, exactly for what you said in that aspect, to try and do a favor to Russia, but in that it will expect some kind of a serious compromise from Russia. And remember, Turkey has significant play in Syria, and many of the ISIS fighters that are still in certain provinces that are still there, they are under Turkish control area. So it's a very dynamic situation. So I don't think it's anything that happened recently. This is a credit card bill that just came due, and President Erdogan is submitting the bill for payment to both the U.S. and Russia, and saying who's going to pay more.
I absolutely agree. That the point is just that the sudden decision, sort of to weaponize this bill right now, after having initially given green signal to the Finnish membership. But okay, I'll leave it at that. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you very much. I mean, you're right. It is weaponized because guess what? It has tremendous value. This is where he stands to get the most significant value as his compromise. Guta, go ahead.
All right. So we go now to Greco and Chris, and after that we can go back to Khaled and Abdul, or Sam if he wants to come in. And Khaled, then we can do some popcorn, have a more dynamic conversation as before closing.
Before we do that, let me just specify. We've been going on now for about an hour and 35 minutes. We will close the conversation in 10 minutes, because otherwise this can carry on for, I can see how the interest level and the engagement value is there. So we will close it in 10 minutes. So, Gutta, if you can just go through the rounds to for anybody who wants to give a last comment and a statement.
Yeah, let's do that. So let's listen to Greco and Chris, and then we go for the rounds.
Great, thank you. Who is the next speaker, Gutta?
Greco.
Hi, my microphone was inactive. Here in Brazil, in the last years, we have a coup of state. Our president was retired, and we need to accept another president without vote, without anything, and the bigger influence that make the people agree with the impeachment was the social networks, the power of WhatsApp, the groups, this like they are like think tanks of WhatsApp and internet, and I really take it very serious because I remember of Zygmunt Bauman, and in the first page of his book Liquid Word, he says that these companies, private companies, technological companies are going so fast that the government cannot follow, and we like citizens, cidadãos aqui no Brasil, we like citizens, we lost our rights because one thing is the government to give us rights, human rights. Other things are companies that only think about themselves. And it's, for me, it's a very big problem, and it was really tragic, the situation here in Brazil. And part of that was because of the internet. And the lack of policy, lack of rules on the about what people speak, what people talk, fake news like that. Just I like to hear you talk. I'm very happy to find this group.
Thank you, Greco. Thank you very much. And what you mean is the misinformation that's going around in Brazil, right?
Yeah.
The manipulation with social media. That's what you wanted to
A lot of time I don't speak English. Sorry, my English.
But, no, you spoke very well, very well. I was just making sure.
These companies, private companies, they are going so fast, then the government cannot follow that. And I think we are dealing with a new kind of government, a government of private companies of technology. And they can do anything because, at least here in Brazil, I pass a lot of problems with Facebook, internet. I lots of problems. And I don't have authority to give me my rights, you know.
But I mean, it's like, do you know about cyber attacks in Brazil?
Yeah. Like I offend people, like hacked my account and offended women, offended people. We have cyber attacks even in the government.
That's the point, exactly. In the government, you know about cyber attacks, and that's what we're talking about here.
Risk
of these cyber attacks, cyber espionage, you know, warfare.
Yeah, it was in that time that Snowden revealed a lot of secrets, and one of secrets he said was the espionage the United States government are making in Brazil and Germany, like that. But the real problem recently was it's like Donald Trump in United States.
Yeah, it's the manipulation using all the technology.
Yeah.
But that's a huge problem, and we have to watch out, especially now this year. Thank you so much, Gregor, for your
participation. Thank you.
And it's important that we Brazilians always voice that risk that we are going through this year, right, to defend our democracy. We have Richard back that has been in the room before, and I know he has a meeting. So you don't mind if I pass to Richard before he goes, right?
No. Okay.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Richard, please.
Hi. Oh, I'm done with the meeting. Thank you for obliging. I think of the earlier rooms, I had mentioned that the legal organs would be behind the times to catch up with the actual rate of cybersecurity events. And I thought maybe there's something even worse. I mean, well, that's not the worst thing. But the anti-intellectualism out there, right? Not only is the public decreasingly, as Elon Musk has maybe properly said, the human society generally keeping up with the rate of technological development is, you know, decreasing. That is, the gap between us and the actual is greater. And to, you know, that's sort of natural, as it is hard to keep up. But worsening the situation is anti-intellectualism, which accelerates, you know, gleefully that gap. It actually perversely wishes to maximize that gap. And, you know, I think in previous times, it's always been there, but now it is at scale thanks to media organs that are new and not entirely thought out, or thought out by people who could care less. And so the public will become decreasingly well-informed or well-armed to inform their legislators, at least in democratic societies, about how to craft laws, to say nothing about the professionals who, if they know better, they're going to use it for their own means, and if they don't know better, then they're dangerously misinformed or inaccurate. So that's the thought on my mind. And thank you, Guta and Khalid, and great to see you all.
Thank you, Richard. Khalid, do you want to comment something, or Abdul?
Can you hear me, by the way? Is my mic better now?
No.
Okay. Let's see.
Now? I think we're
better. Better. It's little. Oh, no, that was Abdul.
Okay, so.
Yeah, you
Abdul Hakim, if you want to interject, please go ahead. I'll follow after you. That's fine.
No, I was just going to say the very good, very, very, very good astute observations vis-a-vis the anti-intellectualism that's unfortunately sweeping the world. Regarding the earlier intervention about Erdogan of Turkey and the stalling of new NATO applications, actually, it reminded me of an Arab proverb. I think goes something like, when you're the anvil, be patient, and when you are the hammer, strike. And I think it's one could argue that Turkey in the past has encountered many delays with its own EU and NATO quests, and thus was the patient anvil. And again, as Khalid had correctly said, I think now it is the hammer and has the leverage to address its other concerns. Thank you.
Abdul Hakim, your point, thank you for confirming. I mean, at the end of the day, anybody who learned supply-side economics will know in capitalism, you always want to buy low and sell high. Well, guess what? There's no purchases here, but there's compromises and prices for those compromises. And Turkey has just found why its vote to say yes, admit has now probably the greatest price to the gamesmanship of geopolitics for the next 100 years. It Finland or Sweden are able to join or not join, and whether Turkey can be the conduit to allow that to happen, will dictate how the future of warfare in that part of the world and the rest of the world. So he knows the price is so high, and if there's one thing, like him or hate him, Erdogan is the ultimate opportunist, and he's using this to this maximum value. And the trick here is he is going to create, you can call it a silent bid or a some kind of an auction, to say to Russia, what will you give me in return of me declining that application? And guess what? He might get that from Russia, and Russia will pay a dear price for that. It's very, very significant. Guta, are we now, is there anybody else that wants to have a final comment before I close?
Yes, Juha wanted to jump in, and then Tina, would you like to say something, Mitch and Abdul, and then that's it.
And can I ask you all to make it very brief so we can wrap it up, please? Thank you very, very much.
I comply with your wish. I'm through. Thank you for excellent discussion.
That's too kind. That's not the kind of compliance I was waiting for. But that's absolutely fine. Thank you, Jean-Paul. But that's fine. Next, Guta.
Tina?
Tina, you have the floor, my dear.
Yes, I'm here. I am here. Yes, I think the most important thing is readiness. And of course, you have to have high democracy, because if you have high democracy, there's no corruption and you have your loyal officers and government working for you. So I think those are just a few arguments could be in other case and in other room. But I appreciated anyhow the discussion. It was absolutely interesting. And thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Tina, for that, for your intervention and your last comment. Much appreciated. Guta, who's next?
It's Mitch.
I yield the mic to Khalid and Abdul, and just thank you for such a substantive conversation tonight. Thank you.
And Richard?
My pleasure. Our pleasure, Mitch. Thank you. Richard?
I yield the mic back. Thank you for hosting.
And Greg.
You're welcome.
Okay, so back to
Abdul. No, I'm fine. Very happy to be here. I think it's very important to talk about that.
Thank you very much, Greg, for your participation again. And Abdul?
Yes, I do have a couple of things to say. Sorry about that. First and foremost, I just want to touch on the issue of what I would call combat innovation. Now, in our part of the world, terrorists are leveraging social media to maximize public pressure, as we saw in the case in Kenya, the Westgate Mall attack. And I think we are also seeing that bad actors, whether they are individuals, terrorist organizations, and in some unfortunate cases, countries, bad actors see cyberspace as a tool to develop and disseminate their propaganda, B, a medium for their illicit activities, whether it's financial, mobilization, planning, and coordination. And C, they see cyberspace as a target. We've seen where, they take down infrastructure, finance systems, and government services, as we're seeing, in the ongoing war in Europe. And I just want to, again, forgive me, quote another gentleman, Barry Green, in Singapore. Cyber criminals operate at the speed of light, while law enforcement moves at the speed of law. And the takeaway from this for all of us is that we really need to develop enhanced what we would call proactive strategies
to complement our, you know, cyber survivability. Because again, it is about survivability. It is about protecting our society, as had earlier been mentioned. And last but not least, if I may quote a mentor of mine, reaction is not the path to success. Reaction is tactical and in most cases, evidence of failure. I yield the mic. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Khaled, with you.
Sam, you want to say something? I think Sam is probably preoccupied somewhere else.
I just shared the link to the book, Khaled, if you want to.
Oh, fantastic.
Finish,
thank you.
Speaking about the book.
Thank you, Sam. Do you want to have a final comment, or would you like to defer?
No, please. You want to speak about the book, because obviously I'm busy on another call at the moment.
God bless you. Well, Guta, thank you now. Sam, thank you. Abdul Hakim, thank you. And all speakers and participants, thank you all. For whatever it's worth, the link to the upcoming book, Survivability, is there. This is not a pitch to sell it. I'm not motivated by money, but it is really about a change of mindset. And I urge you all to go and read about the post itself. So why I have taken so much time of my time to write the book and why I'm doing this. That's one. Secondly, I'm so pleased at the level of participation and the engagement and the interventions that have come through. It tells me that our time was well allocated to do this. The goal was to create higher awareness that even with us, the best of us who think that we are as more ready than anybody else, there's always room for improvement. And unfortunately, we will only be tested under adversity, and I hope that adversity never happens. The truth of the matter here is prior to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the world was in a bad situation to a large extent, but there was not this level of direct military conflict that just made many actions plausible that would not have been plausible prior to the invasion. Currently, human life suffering stand to be seriously compromised, which will have direct impact on lives and livelihoods of people all over the world. And all you need to see, we're talking about food shortages, we're talking about compromises, shrinking economies. I mean, the shelves in many parts of the world today are missing certain food ingredients because they get produced in the Ukraine and Russia. If anybody does not realize the level of interdependence of society is, wake up and smell the coffee. And this is my last statement here. We need to challenge our political representatives in government that we want them to do things differently. Those who cherish democracy, those who actually pride themselves that they are in democratic nations, well, guess what? Our democratic countries are not doing the right thing, and they're leading us astray. And unless we, the electorate, put them on notice and challenge them and hold them to account to make sure that they deliver on the things that we all want. Nobody wants wars. We all want to live in peace. Majority of us want to live in peace, and majority of us want to be respected and self-respected. So it is our role to challenge the incumbents. And those who don't, guess what? Put them out. One last point. I mean, if anybody's watching British politics, and I'm going to go on record. I have called him a buffoon before. I'm sorry, this is a tangent. I've called him a buffoon before he became prime minister. I still call him a buffoon. But that's, guess what? The disinformation made Boris Johnson prime minister, a proven liar with an 82 or 84 seat majority in the House of Commons, plus serial exposure of lies and deception, and he's still in power. What does that say about our democracies? This is a beacon of democratic values around the world. I am certain we can do a lot better and to serve the public good. On that point, on that tangent, I thank you all. I bid you farewell. Stay in touch. Join the group Cyber War and NGP Cyber Warfare, so at least you become updated with the next sessions. And I think these conversations today had come up with some significant topics. And I think soon you're going to be hearing us talking about the peril of cyber insurance, a key component that we have unique expertise in that space, ladies and gentlemen. So on that note, I thank you all. We will close the room and ask and hope to see you soon on the next sessions. Guta, anything else for House of Rules?
No, just follow the club, follow the moderators, follow each other, and soon we'll announce the next room, and I hope you all come back here and participate. Thank you.
Thank you all, and have a great day or evening, and until next time, stay safe.
Thank you very much.